This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Lynne Malcolm, kicking off a new year of All in the Mind programs on RN. Today, we explore the big questions about what it is to be human and do we have any control over our own fate?
I think this idea of free will, having agency, having the ability to shape our lives, or the idea that maybe free will is just an illusion and actually quite a lot of life choices are predetermined. These types of questions have really intrigued our species since our civilization really arose.
Dr. Hannah Critchlow is a neuroscientist at Cambridge University. Ever since she worked with adolescents as a nursing sister in the local psychiatric hospital over 20 years ago, she's been interested in the science of fate. The young people she worked with had various mental disorders, and largely good treatment wasn't available or was ineffective for them. She decided to join the field of neuroscience to explore how the fate of these young people could be changed.
We now have the tools that are allowing us to really dissect the nuts and bolts of how our behaviours arise and how our decisions in our life are made. And it seems increasingly that there's a huge amount of personalities, our temperaments, the way that we go about our everyday lives that eventually make up our life stories. A lot of those choices are actually biologically ingrained in us from the moment that we're born in some ways. So you can now have a look at the brain circuitry, how that is formed in a baby at 20 weeks gestation. So there's incredible MRI technology that's allowing us to scan a baby within the mother's womb and see the different neural signatures that might predispose that individual, that baby, to developing conditions like, for example, autism or schizophrenia or depression. And at the moment, the focus of this research is very much on medical conditions associated with mental ill health. But the data is also going to be freely available to the whole scientific community so that they can follow the life trajectories of these babies and see whether particular temperaments might also be biologically ingrained. And the suspicion is that very much so, yes, even higher cognitive functions, how long you might live, your resilience to mental ill health, even your socioeconomic status, the career that you might choose, for example, all of these have a high genetic component. Now, there's another view, which is that actually we have a huge scope within our lives to shape ourselves in much the same way that we can kind of hone our body through exercise and change our muscles. We can also change our behaviours and change any habits that we might have and boost any skill sets that we want to. And there's been this wonderful idea that's been around really for a very long time, but it has especially been prominent within our culture, this idea of plasticity, that we can shape our brain and change our brain power in any way that we want to, as long as we have the will.
The idea of brain plasticity really gained a lot of traction about 20 years ago when Professor Eleanor Maguire at University College London did a groundbreaking study where she looked at the brains of London cab drivers. She found that the cabbies who scored best in tests for their navigation skills had growth in the hippocampus. This is the region of the brain involved in learning, memory, and navigation through space.
And so this really sparked the public's imagination, this idea that you can boost your brain power and literally expand areas of your brain as you revise. And we were kind of almost sold this idea of unlimited plasticity, this ability to meld our brain in any way. But actually, it seems now that maybe some of these cabbie drivers, the ones that didn't pass the test, they didn't have an increased hippocampal region. Maybe they had a biological ingrained mechanism whereby they didn't have the scope for such plasticity within their brain. Maybe they had different skill sets and their hippocampus couldn't actually enhance in this way. Mm-hmm. And so maybe there were just some people that are predisposed to become cabbie drivers. So there's still lots of questions that have been really unanswered. But one thing that has particularly come out of this type of research is this idea through cognitive behavioral therapy that we can train our brain to change the way that we think and to make new associations so that we can start thinking maybe more positively rather than ruminating on our past, which is a wonderful idea and it can be very successful in a lot of people. But for those people that it's not successful in, those people that are still struggling with mental health problems, for example, depression or anxiety or post-traumatic stress disorder, what do we say to them? Do we say, oh, you're not working hard enough, you know, you need to enhance your plasticity a little bit more, you need to think your way through it? Sometimes this is not possible and other strategies need to be adopted. We shouldn't blame these people for not being able to think their way out of different conditions.
So let's go back to the beginning of a human's life. We tend to think of a newborn baby as a clean slate, but it's far more complex than that. For example, how influential is the baby's experience in the womb for their lives ahead?
There's still a lot of unanswered questions. But what we're seeing is that increasingly there's a high hereditary basis, a high genetic basis for a lot of higher cognitive functions, including things like some people might be more genetically predisposed to impulsivity, for example. So they might be pre-wired to seek out sensations, new sensations, much more than other people. And this obviously has an evolutionary benefit to us as a society, because we need people within our society who are driven, motivated, derive a lot of pleasure from being adventurous and testing boundaries, if you like, and wanting to see the world in a new way. But there's also seems to be a genetic basis for compulsivity as well, which can lead to some people being more predisposed to, unfortunately, having problems with addiction later on in life.
Not only do genetics determine us and our lives, but the field of epigenetics opens up intergenerational considerations too. Can you give an example of the research that's going on there? There was one particular one that I read about that involved giving subjects an electric shock whilst being exposed to the smell of cherries, for example.
Yeah, which sounds a little bit mean, doesn't it?
It does.
So there's our higher complex kind of behaviours, like impulsivity, compulsivity, intelligence, for example, that I was talking about earlier. But the book also talks about everyday basic behaviours, for example, our food preferences and how a lot of weight predisposition might be genetically ingrained as well. And it's thought that something like how much we weigh might have a basis of something like 70% genetic predisposition. And there's hundreds of genes that are involved or implicated in obesity or how much we weigh. And there's one standout gene that's really implicated in it, which is called the FTO gene, which if you're unlucky enough to contain two of the particular variants of this gene, then you will on average weigh about 5 kilograms more than the person next to you, and you've got a much higher chance of also developing clinical obesity. And this, there's an evolutionary reason for this. So back in the days when our ancestors were in the savannah, they needed to have a huge amount of motivation and derive a lot of pleasure from going out and eating food. And so we had this genetic predisposition, this wiring that's built into us. In order for us to survive, we need to have this strong motivation and get a huge sense of reward from food. So that's how this behavior has kind of seeped into us through our genes. But obviously the environment is very different now. So there's been a lot of research because of the current obesity epidemic. There's been a lot of research looking at how we can possibly circumnavigate some of our genetic predispositions to gaining weight. And there was one researcher that was based in America who did some fantastic studies, and it kind of left the neuroscience community reeling, actually, the implications of these results. So he was looking in mice, and he wafted into their cages the smell, the sweet smell of cherry, which usually will get a mouse kind of really alert and excited and almost salivating, very motivated by the thought that it might soon be able to find a nice sweet tasting cherry that it can nibble on. However, the research lab started to change this association by pairing the sweet smell of cherry with a mild electric shock for this mouse. And they did this a few times so that the mouse very quickly learned to associate the smell of cherry with the unpleasant electric shock. And so instead of getting excited and running around sniffing, looking for this cherry, it would freeze and contract its muscle in preparation for receiving this mild electric shock. Okay, so they did that a few times, and the mouse really quickly learnt this new association. And then they left the mouse to its own devices. It had a very happy life. There was no more smell of cherry that was wafted in, and there was no more mild electric shocks either. And the mouse kind of got on with its life. It found a mate, happily started a family, and its children then had a lovely, happy life. There was no smell of cherries involved and no electric shock. And then these mice went on to have their children as well. So now we're talking about the grandchildren of the original mice in the study. And the grandchildren had never been exposed to the smell of cherries. They had never been exposed to an electric shock. And so the research lab wondered what would happen if they wafted in this sweet smell of cherries. Would it follow what was evolutionarily ingrained within the brain and start getting very excited about the potential taste of a cherry coming around, or would it have learnt this association from its grandparents through some mechanism that it would start freezing in anticipation of a mild electric shock? And what happened was that the mouse, the grandchild, actually froze as if it was about to receive an electric shock. And this wasn't really expected. They thought that they wouldn't be able to learn this new association from the grandparents. You know, how had this memory been passed across the generations? And what they found was that when they looked into the brains of the grandchildren mice, there'd been a rewiring from the olfactory centre, the sniff processing centre within the brain, and a circuit that originally had gone to the nucleus accumbens, which is involved in reward and pleasure and motivation, had instead been redirected to the amygdala, which is another area of the brain which is involved in fear and disgust response. As soon as they smelt this cherry, that was sending an electric signal to the amygdala to say, be frightened, be afraid, because you might be getting an electric shock. So how was this happening? How was this new circuitry description being sent down across the generations? It wasn't occurring in the DNA of the grandparents in itself. There wasn't a change within the genetic coding of these base pairs. Instead, what was happening was that there was a change epigenetically in the way that the DNA was being folded and its conformation, and the way that its conformation could be changed so that the DNA could be opened up and particular genes could be expressed. And what they found was that the grandfather's DNA in his sperm had been epigenetically changed so that the conformation of the DNA in a particular region that's involved in genes being expressed, instructing how the neural circuitry from the olfactory center to the amygdala should be laid down in the babies, had actually changed. So there'd been an epigenetic change within the sperm of the grandfather, and this had been passed on across generations. Now, this kind of research really was absolutely fascinating, and it gives us a window into the types of mechanisms by which memories can be passed on through generations from our ancestors as well. Now, I'm not saying that what we should be doing is kind of outside bakeries when we smell these amazing, delicious smells of donuts, for example, and fresh bread. We should be starting to give everybody a mild electric shock in order to try and combat the obesity problem that's currently affecting the large majority of the world. But it is providing us with a greater knowledge and how our behaviours can be formed and how they can be shaped by what our ancestors have experienced in combination with the genetic code that they have given us. So there is scope for plasticity and change within our brain alongside the genetic predispositions that we can't really change unless we do some very science fiction, if you like, but it's not science fiction, gene editing changes.
You're with All in the Mind on RN. I'm Lynn Malcolm. With me is Dr. Hannah Critchlow, neuroscientist from Cambridge University. Her latest book, The Science of Fate: Why Your Future is More Predictable Than You Think, explores how increasing knowledge of neuroscience can be applied to help people suffering mental health and neurological conditions.
At its basic level, it can help people understand that it's not their fault that they might be suffering from particular conditions, and that it can help their family to understand as well what's happening, and that there is a biological reason for these behaviours, these challenging behaviours that are being exhibited. So hopefully that can help with empathy and compassion. But also it's providing us with mechanisms by which new treatments can be developed that can pinpoint and target very particular ways that are underpinning some of these conditions. And new treatments are being developed all the time. So, for example, as we understand which particular neural circuits are involved in behaviours like, for example, addiction, obsessive compulsive disorder, or even depression. There's been some incredible studies recently that have taken people that have been treatment resistant, showing really very severe symptoms of these conditions, and drilled into their brains, opened up their brains, and embedded in a mild electric shock panel, a very small miniature electric shock panel, into very discrete areas within the brain, so that they can literally switch on and switch off particular circuits within the brain to completely switch on and switch off symptoms of heroin addiction, for example, or obsessive compulsive disorder or chronic depression. So this knowledge of our neural circuitry is being used to help patients that otherwise wouldn't be able to recover in any other way. Also, the results are showing us that there is still scope for plasticity within our brain. So everything isn't completely and utterly fixed. There is still scope for us to change our behaviours through the power of plasticity, and that there's ways that we can help cultivate a greater degree of plasticity within our brain. And that's through exercise, for example, making sure that we challenge ourselves to learn new things, to keep our brain flexible, to discuss our viewpoint, our very unique sense of reality with other people, and to keep debating with other individuals to keep our brain plastic, and also to eat in healthy ways. So the general rule is to eat for your heart and your brain as one. So anything that keeps all of the blood supply going, pumping to your brain, and keeps all the different areas of the brain getting all the oxygen that it needs in order for the neural circuitry to pass electric currents around, which is a hugely energy consuming process. Anything that can help with that oxygen getting to the brain is going to be good for our plasticity and our behaviours. And also to get a good night's sleep in order for us to be able to consolidate everything that we've learned from the day before and then integrate it within our framework of reality so that it can affect the way that we make choices the next day.
Political ideology is something that we think of as a product of our experience or the attitudes around us. But how are brain structures like the amygdala involved in determining whether someone is politically conservative or liberal-minded?
Oh, yeah, so that's a really interesting question. There's been some really fascinating research that's been coming out looking at this recently. And it seems to be that those people that are of the more conservative bent will have a much more responsive amygdala, this area that's involved in the fear response. They'll have a heightened sensitivity within their amygdala as well. Whereas people that are of the more liberal ideology seem to have less sensitive amygdala, and instead different areas of the brain that are involved in more creative, collaborative problem solving and looking forwards to the future in a more strategic way, those areas of the brain will be much more active and have a higher volume instead. Now, both types of people are probably important within our society. So, for example, those people that are risk averse and are worried about the now, those people that might be more conservative, for example, are obviously helpful in helping to preserve the state of affairs now. Whereas those people that are more able to creatively problem solve and partner up with different people and think in different ways are obviously very important for our future and innovation and creative problem solving for the future of our species. Now, interestingly, what you can do is you can switch an individual's brain from the liberal ideology to the more conservative bent by basically giving them a heightened sense of fear about the situation at the moment. And that's what quite a lot of propaganda has done throughout history. It's heightened people's sense of fear. It's made their amygdala spark up with activity and be incredibly sensitive by inundating them with propaganda messages that make them feel frightened and susceptible to attack. And so you can actually change the voting patterns of people on quite a large scale by terrorizing them with fear, if you like.
Mm. We see that happening around us.
Yes.
Mm. Hannah Critchlow is passionate about the cutting-edge technologies that are being developed which help us understand our brain and behaviour and how that will shape us in the future. But even more interesting is consciousness itself.
What's going to be really exciting to watch is how our understanding of our own consciousness arises, how the connectome within our mind gives rise to the complex behaviours that humans exhibit. As we learn more and more about that and start being able to emulate it in artificial neural networks for artificial intelligence, I think it's going to be incredible to watch how that makes us view ourselves as humans and maybe start to question how similar we might be to some of the artificial systems that are being developed.
So all these technologies and the new research that's happening really does challenge our notion of whether we really do have free will. What are the challenges of living with that concept of not really having free will?
Yeah, exactly. So I think as we're learning more and more and more about the brain, and we start to see it as this biological entity that follows physical laws, so information comes in from our outside world, we process that information, and that gives rise to our thoughts, our emotions, and dictates how we interact with the rest of the world. So it's a simple in-out system, and our behaviour is the output. So it's very similar to how the rest of our body works, you know, how our digestive system works, how our liver works, how we process signals that are coming in, and it functions in a particular way, which is largely also governed by the genes that we were given. So some people might have a predisposition to diabetes, for example, and so they have to watch their blood sugar levels. As we start to accept this more and more, as the biological information, the neuroscience information that's coming out, forces us to accept that our brains and our behaviours are also following similar rules, then we really do start to have to question how much free will we have. And there's been some really lovely studies done by scientists looking at what the ramifications are of us having to accept that free will is largely an illusion. And the upshot of that is that basically, as we accept more and more that we don't have a huge amount of agency, what we see is that people behave much more selfishly and they act in a way that doesn't have so much social care for other people. So what do we do with that information? And so how do we try and accept what neuroscience is telling us, that there's a lot of our behaviours that are predetermined or pre-wired into us, whilst still acting with compassion for those around us? And I think what we have to start doing is placing ourselves within society where we celebrate the strength of having neurodiversity. So we start to appreciate more and more the idiosyncrasies, the strengths and the flaws of other individuals and their brains, so that we appreciate, for example, different behaviours and realise that as a society, as a structure as a whole, we need this breadth, this scope for a diversity in different behaviours and different people. And there's also been quite a lot of neuroscience, really. There's a new publication called The Science Handbook of Compassion, which is looking at the science of how we generate more compassion and altruism within our society. And there's some really interesting research that's coming out from that field as well.
So you're advocating the neuroscience of compassion. I just wonder, how can we accomplish that? Because aren't we really self-serving creatures?
So that is one view. And Richard Dawkins, for example, called his groundbreaking book The Selfish Gene, kind of almost advocating that human beings are inherently selfish and there's nothing really that we can do about that. But actually, there's a huge amount of research that's showing that innately we do hold a lot of natural altruism for others. And when you look at what happens within the brain when someone acts in an altruistic way, actually they're deriving a huge amount of reward and pleasure from it. Their nucleus accumbens is sparking into life and they're feeling really motivated and pleased with themselves and happy with themselves. And this is wired into us. We want to help other people within our society to differing degrees. Some people have it more than others, because actually we are wired to derive a lot of pleasure from it. So selfishly, it gives us something. So there's also a genetic biological basis for that as well. So there's a lot of hope, I think.
As we've been talking about, biological predispositions are there when we're born and they dictate the way we live and how we see the world. So When, if at all, do we have free will? I mean, for example, we have free will to be altruistic, for example, what you've just talked about.
So there is always scope for plasticity within our brains. That's the nature of us being conscious beings. We have to be able to have the capability to learn from our environments on a daily basis and integrate that learnt information into the architecture, the circuitry within our brain, which will then alter our perception of the world the next day, which can then impact on our decision making. And we need that scope for plasticity in order to be subjective conscious beings. Without it, we wouldn't be able to survive. We wouldn't be able to learn to protect ourselves, for example. So this plasticity really underpins our survival as individuals and as species. And this is really where free will allows us to have some capacity for. So anything that we can do to enhance our plasticity on a daily basis can help us enhance any ability that we might have for having agency in our lives. So again, talking about the things that can enhance our plasticity, it's exercise, it's talking to other people, it's continually challenging ourselves to learn new things, and eating healthily for our brain's flexibility and energy demands. There were some studies that were done in the 1980s by Benjamin Libe, and they were very crude studies looking at free will. And basically, he hooked up some volunteers, measured the electrical activity within their brain and the motor cortex, a region that's involved in directing movement within the body. And then he also hooked up the hand so that he could detect when muscles were contracting in the hand. And he asked somebody, the volunteers, to move their hand in a wave fashion, so to wave at somebody else across the room. And he asked the individuals to record when they were directing their hand to move. And what he found was that the brain firstly directed the hand to move, and then 350 or so milliseconds later, the person reported that they were consciously directing their hand to move, and then the hand actually moved. So this was really surprising. So he was thinking that actually what should be happening is that you are consciously aware of the fact that you are directing movement within your body. But actually what was happening was the brain, before you were even consciously aware that you were directing movement in your body, your brain was actually causing that movement to occur. The electric signals were already there. And so this 350 or so millisecond delay between you being consciously aware of your direction, you're having this kind of agency, this delay was actually, some people believe, provides a pause within your brain for you by which you can actually stop any activity going on. So any behaviours, any movements, any communication that might occur. And this might be where we have scope for free will. There's a small time delay within our brain. There's a pause window by which we can stop any behaviours arising. And so anything that we can do to try and make use of that pause button allows us this freedom of will, if you like. But As I was mentioning earlier, some people seem to be pre-wired, seem to have a genetic predisposition to be more impulsive than others. So maybe they're less likely to make use of that pause button. So, yeah, I think also there's been some lovely studies that are looking at how collective consciousness arises and collective intelligence arises. And we each have a skewed version of reality, which is based on the brain circuitry that has built up over the decades of our lives. And that affects the way that we perceive the world. So we each have this very unique version of reality that's not quite aligned with the real reality, the real situation that's going on around us. But by discussing our unique version of reality with other people, we are more likely to get to a closer, more accurate depiction of the real situation. And so I think maybe that's one way that we can exert some free will, is to allow ourselves to be open to dialogue and debate with other people in order to generate a higher collective consciousness and a higher collective intelligence.
Dr. Hannah Critchlow, neuroscientist at Cambridge University, Science Outreach Fellow at Magdalen College, and author of The Science of Fate. And it's published by Hodder and Stoughton. Thanks to producer Diane Dean and sound engineer Isabella Tropiano. I'm Lynn Malcolm. Catch you next time. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.